they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole.
Get we found ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
All right, and live, and good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome down to Security Rabbit Hole to yet another edition of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast, recorded and streamed live to YouTube for my first try ever. We'll see how this goes. If I like it, we'll do it again. And who better to have on than Mr. Jeremiah Grossman. Hey, man, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Yeah,
it's... Usually we see each other once or twice a year, but not the last year.
it's been a while, and I skipped the RSA before that. So I skipped RSA, didn't have Black Hat. We're not going to, well, RSA is virtual now.
So
my next hope is I'm going out to Vegas for Black Hat this year, hell or high water. We'll see how that works.
I'm like 80-20, 80% go, 20% stay. I'm probably going to be there. I'm just curious what it's going to be like. You know, I had a sneaking suspicion that Black Hat might be what Black Hat was 10 years ago. Intimate gatherings, the diehards that really want to go and get together and have some cool... Like, I'm actually kind of looking forward to it.
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen is you're going to get that the people that really want to go and not the ones that have to go for work.
Yeah.
So it'll be maybe refreshing for a while. It's gotten, like we all complain about, super commercialized all right, so the reason you're here and I'm chatting with you, because as always, some thought-provoking Twitter posts. You've done the software liability thing a number of times. You've been on that topic. All right, let's start there, because I think that caught my attention. You know, you said something equivalent of hold the manufacturers accountable, make them pay for it, and if it's gotten security tested and passed and still has issues, hold the security vendors liable. And I was like, yeah, it sounds great in theory, but let's talk about it. So give me your position and we'll take it from there.
Yeah, let's go back to the origin, the genesis of this particular idea. So I was having a conversation with my dad, who is one of my longtime business mentors. And I was telling him what I did. You know, we scan websites or vulnerabilities for a living. Hopefully the customer fixes it and they become more secure. He goes, you're kind of like in the insurance business. I was like, well, you know, what do you mean? And he was kind of explaining it to me. I was like, no, we're not in the insurance business. And I said proudly, well, I'm not insurance because we don't pay off. And as I was saying it, I was almost like embarrassed. Like, I'm charging people money to say these are the things that you should do. And if they get hacked afterwards, I'm not liable. Like, that doesn't seem right. And, you know, so I let that sit for a while. And then, you know, competing in the application security world, I was always in a position where, I'll just say it, my competitors would always lie and be able to lie convincingly to say that they're better, cheaper, faster than me. And I know that they weren't. I knew what I had was the best. And there was nothing I could do to counteract the lies. So finally, one day I got fed up and said, you know what? I know my data. I know how good I am. I know if customers just fix the vulns that I say, the odds of them getting hacked is infinitesimally small. So why not just warranty it? So after much haranguing, working with cyber insurance carriers, I said, look to the customer. These are the vulnerabilities I promised to find. If I miss anything on that list and it gets you hacked, I'll cover the first $1 million on your losses. I'll be right there with you with the same incentives. And that's where the idea came from.
Okay. So I got to ask, did you guys ever pay out? Did you guys have to ever get in that situation? Can you share that?
Yeah, we never had a payout because we never had a claim either. I was actually really hopeful we would at least have a claim, let alone a payout.
Because data point, right?
Yeah, at least a data point of one. But when it came down to it, I had 10 years of data across 1,000 companies, and like the failure rate was like 0.08%, like something ridiculously small. Our customers would get hacked, you know, like as customers do, on vulnerabilities what we did find all the time, so we were never liable in that way. But right. these are the same objections that they gave to the cyber insurance industry. Like, just wait till you send a claim to the insurance carriers, they'll never pay. They pay the vast majority of the times. Like, it's not that at all.
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, let's start with, I'm actually more interested in getting the developer of the software to a point of accountability. I'm not even saying like, okay, if at some point, there's complexities to it, right? And we can unpack that, but I'm more focused on whoever's making it, because they ultimately own the responsibility for doing something with it that makes it more secure, makes it safe. I want to caution, and I'm always cautious about pushing us down towards a risk of zero, right? Because we're never getting there. And I think there's a number of factors that say a piece of software that I put out today that's safe now has a diminishing return over time, potentially, because new things get discovered, blah, blah, blah. But there should be some way to quantify that at a point in time. Yes, this thing was good to this specification. The challenge I had was when I ran AppSec programs is I tried to get there, but I could never get that spec right. I could never say like, oh, you can't be, you know, SQL injection, cross-site scripting, or XSRF or whatever, because there's always the argument against me would be, well, there's always new techniques for that. How do we get ahead of all that, right? Because if you say no XSS and there's some novel new, we don't have any today, but in 6 months, some novel new way, is that technically the same? Or do I have to list all the ways today? Like, you see what I'm saying?
I don't know exactly what you're saying. What we're dealing with, a moving target and sentient adversaries. Okay.
Yes.
Let's leave that there just for a moment and understand that there are corollaries from our industry. We're not the first industry to grapple with this. Like, for instance, if I go to Best Buy and buy a Sony TV, they're going to give me a 1-year warranty. Do those TVs sometimes break? Sure. Are they trying to make the perfect TV every single one of them? No, of course not. They have a business ratio. They know a certain percentage of them will break, and they'll have to refund me, and that's built into the cost of everybody else's TV so they can make money. Other than the fact that we are dealing with sentient adversaries, other than like children running around with hammers and things like that, we are very, very similar. So here's how when I did my warranty at White Hat, these are the volumes that I'm aware of today, right? And these are the ones I'll warranty, because this is what I know today. And I said in the contract, if there's new techniques that come out, I just need a grace period. 30 days should be enough for most cases to catch up. So I'll cover the unknown. I just need 30 days to get there. And that was it. And everybody accepted that. Because if you really look at the breaches, who's getting hacked by purely brand new techniques and purely brand new vulns? Frickin' no one. You know, if they didn't give me a grace period, I would have bet on the future anyway, because no one's using those.
Yeah, that's fair. Look, and we get these cases where, like, was it in the company Excellion or whatever, that one that the file transfer service that had come out, and it was like, you know, 10, 15 years out there. And, you know, I made a comment of, you know, there's a certain, it turns into like the boulder rolling down the hill, right? The longer a piece of software stays not updated, the harder it is to bring it up to some level of, you know, modern whatever code spec. Three revs and 6 months later, doable. 16 revs and 4 years later, like, okay, you're gonna have to probably change a monumental amount of things, and it'll probably break twice. And It seems on the customer side, super, I don't want to say counterintuitive, but like, you want to try to save money, so you want to push out updates as long as you can. You want to be able to keep configurations as non-changing as possible, right? So you want to keep a stable environment, but at the same time, you're slowly walking yourself towards a cliff that there's a point where you can't come back. Right, we ran into this at when I worked at GE. Their software that was so old that there was no upgrade path for. You're like, you know what? You're 3 full revs back. Like, it's a full fresh install. We're like, no. But we have all these configs. We have all these things that depend on this thing. They're like, yeah, those API endpoints don't exist anymore. And so we got stuck.
So we'll go through two examples of this. So for instance, when let's say a white hat would find a vulnerability in a system, we would work for security, and security would try to beg, borrow, and steal, trying to get the development team to fix the issue, right? And there's business issues because it's either you spend development resources creating revenue-generating features that if slip will cost the company money versus fixing a vuln that might get hacked and might cost them money, what do you do? So what happened was is that when we put this warranty pressure into the system, security could go to the VP of engineering or the CFO and go, look, fix these vulns, because if we don't and we get hacked, we sacrifice our $1 million insurance policy. And that changed the conversation a lot. It brought it into a realm of economics. And
that's an interesting point.
And that's the same you find in a lot of different areas. You have to reduce things into dollars and cents. If the customer doesn't do this, their insurance policy won't pay off.
Yeah.
And then, because it's not like the developers don't want to fix these issues. They want to fix them fine. It's just, which one do you do? The feature or the bug?
Yeah. Yeah, they're on the constraints, right? They're not being paid to fix old stuff. They're being paid to develop new stuff to the customer. Yeah, I get it. On the side of the manufacturer, so playing devil's advocate for a second, making the developer accountable for an issue that is found in a security bug that's found in their code, it's then exploited. I'm on board with. I like the idea. I think that there's that it isn't going to be too difficult to try to enforce, with the caveat that there has to be accountability for, hey, we put out the patch, we notified the customer sat on it. I'm sorry, I'm not responsible for this, because within a reasonable amount of time, like, I think all this comes down to is defining reasonable parameters, like you said, right? Give me a grace period. So if there's a bug that's discovered in my software that I put out, say I'm using some open source library, there's a bug in that, I say, okay, I'm going to go make a fix. The industry and the lawyers have to agree what is a reasonable time to fix, or we'll end up battling it out in court at some point, which will solve that.
I think that reasonable time had mostly to do with between the customer and vendor. The industry should have no say. I have no idea what the SLAs for that company is or their tolerance for risk would be. I have no idea what they paid that vendor for the software or their services or what their SLA. I don't think that grace period should be an industry standard. I think that should be a deal standard.
Okay. Do we... Go ahead, finish.
I want to make sure I get the... You can make the actual person, the employee, developer, responsible in some way. But when you say make the developer responsible, you mean the software vendor and not the
vendor. I meant the vendor. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Because holding one person accountable for a system that could potentially be flawed is different, right?
Yeah. Okay. I just want to make sure I hash it right.
Yeah. So I want to hold the vendor accountable. And you know, you bring up an interesting point. Already in software maintenance agreements, right, we sign these, we pay maintenance on software to make sure that it's always got the latest features, it works, you know, with whatever is, you know, new version of Windows, new version of Mac, whatever. Why is it, I guess, in 2021, why isn't the liability built in? Like, what's been holding us back? Isn't it there?
It's not, my opinion, it's the greatest question ever. In my opinion, it's not technological. It's psychological. Our poor customers, whether they're customers of security or customers of software vendors, are suffering Stockholm syndrome. For some reason, they're the most ardent detractors of software liability, as if they don't deserve it. These guys can't make perfect software, so therefore we don't deserve SLAs or warranties. We are so trained to creep through every shrink wrap software agreement like that's just what we do. It's the way it's always been and the way it's always will be. I just think it's Stockholm syndrome. Like, they deserve, they're paying the security industry $120 billion to get hacked every day. Like, would they deserve better?
Yeah, and well, so like Microsoft is, I wouldn't say completely, but they've largely figured that out, right? That it is detrimental to them to not have a security mentality into the company. Apple's figured that out, like in their battle with Android. Is it competition? Is there not enough competition? Is that, I mean, what do you, I don't know.
I think
Stockholm Syndrome is an explanation, but like, what the hell?
It's just not something any buyer of software ever thought to ask. They get laughed out of the room every time they try. The vendors will snicker at them. It's just, it's ego. It's psychological. I mean, there's no reason. I mean, like, for instance, I would pressure other vendors, my competitors, to do the same thing, or in other industries. I would ask them this very simple question. Do you know how well your product works mathematically under a given set of constraints? Do you know what it can stand up to, the type of adversary, what type of viruses get through, what type of vulnerabilities miss? Do you know how well your product works? They go, yes, absolutely. Great, warranty it. And they go, well, it's not perfect. No one's asking for it to be perfect. And you can see right there, it's either one, their product didn't work, or two, it didn't work, or they didn't know how well it worked. If they knew those things, there's no reason why not.
I mean, that's 100% fair, and I'm, now that I'm thinking through it, I mean, it boggles my mind that there isn't a movement, there hasn't been somebody that said, all right, we'll be the first. Where's the rest of the industry?
Well, in security, there's probably 24 warranties now. They're kind of below the radar. I don't know why they don't get more visible, but there's about 24 warranties. I know of two more that are coming within the next month or two. People will like them. It'll turn some heads. But the real groundswell movement is not on the vendor side. It's not on the supply side of the warranties or the SLAs. It's on the demand side. Customers must demand. And when they demand, when they buy with their dollars, when they pressure vendors, the vendors will do it. I mean, that's how they got service level SLAs. They'll do it. And I'm sitting here daily telling customers they can. They can ask for it. It's reasonable. Do it.
Is it going to take, you think it'll be some sort of catalyst event, but I mean, we've seen all of them. Like what else could possibly happen? That I don't want to ask. I really don't want to know the answer to that question, but like, is it going to take, you know, catastrophic loss of life? Like what is it going to take to make people realize that they can and should be asking for some sort of assurance?
I don't know. It's really hard to say. I think one of the things is when the business says you don't get any more money, you're going to have to do more with what you already have. So here's the thing. I like looking through the economics of InfoSec, you know, a lot. We spend about $120 billion a year in InfoSec. If we doubled the spend, would we half the breaches? Probably not.
Because we have been increasing, and the breaches have been increasing along that same trend line.
So then we go through like, why is that? Is that because the security products don't work? Or is it because we're spending on the wrong things, or some combination of the two? Because also we're not, you know, the security industry doesn't suffer any liability in this. They give us $120 billion, everybody gets hacked, and we go, thanks, you know, sucks to be you. And they go, and then the number one pushback from the security industry goes, the customers implemented it wrong, which might be the case, but it just shows the complete conflict of interest between everyone.
Yeah.
And this is where we get into more liability, like insurance, and everybody hates insurance. Fine. But mark my words, and so far, the insurance industry will cause more of the corrective effort we need than anything else we've seen before. And it should scare the entire industry when the insurance carriers are going to know what works and what doesn't work better than we do.
I think that's bound to happen. We've got to be getting close to that place, because the cyber policies and the issuers that I've talked to for the longest time, you know, I say longest, but for the last couple of years have just been sort of like, finger in the air, well, this feels like we could, and the losses have been minimal, and they're still making money on it, so it's not like it's, you know, killing them, but some of these numbers are piling up, and I think in the enterprise space, the very large companies, I think the losses can get to a point where you can put them, frankly, under the financial rug. The further down into the mid-market, into the small companies you go, the more potentially business ending these things get. I mean, look at, not to pick on them, but this pipeline company, right? I mean, they had, from what I heard, some sort of locker variant, but crypto variant. But if it had been a piece of software that got hacked, right, you're now potentially liable and accountable for, I mean, lots of things that you're opened up to. How do you go back and say, well, you know, not our fault, or like, there's got to be a fix throughout this chain.
Some software product inside a Colonial that got hacked. Not a security product, just some product. This is how the product is designed to be used. This is what you have to do. And if it do that, it'll do what its business mission is, and it won't get hacked. So there's a partnership that, yes, the customer must do the things they need to do. If the customer did everything that was expected of them in the contract and it still got hacked, the vendor should be liable within some constraints. It can't be uncapped, unlimited liability. No one would go for that, but some amount. And then, you know, when that's done, then their insurance can pay off. Same thing on the security vendor. Security vendor does an audit, you know, provides a WAF, whatever. Customer is supposed to configure it a certain way and do a certain thing. If the customer did everything that was expected of them, then the security vendor should have some amount of capped liability. Not unlimited, but capped liability. Now everybody's sharing in the risk. What'll happen now with cyber insurance, and cyber insurance was doing very well the last many years. I think reports have it they're gonna take a 30% loss in 2021 because of ransomware. Like, it caught them really by surprise. But you have to understand that these are sunk costs. This is their R&D. They're now getting smarter because they're going to look at the actuarials and provide new guidance. And this is where it's going to change everything. This is where the liability rolls downhill. The insurance carrier is going to say, do X, Y, and Z, or buy X, Y, and Z. Otherwise, we're not covering you, or your premiums go way up. What's the business going to do?
Yeah, so that is where I think the change happens. I don't think it's us waving our hands and saying, you know, you have to do security. I think what's going to happen is exactly what you just stated, is insurance companies at the next premium are going to go, hey, before we renew you, we're going to go ahead and run a quick audit on you and just double check that you're doing A, B, C, and D.
Right there, that's almost true. It'll be an always on audit. They're going to scan you. Many carriers already are.
Okay. Interesting. So like a pen test, bone scan kind of thing, or what?
Yeah, if you look at the actuarials, the companies are only getting hacked by three, maybe five things. So they're just scanning the entire enterprise for those three and five things all the time. Hey, you got an RDP port over here. Close that. That's an easy win.
Yeah. So they're going to continue to, I mean, hopefully the companies that are buying insurance will be the ones that raise the bar. And then there'll be the leaders and the laggards, and suddenly those that don't have insurance will find it very difficult to survive a breach because of litigation, and rightfully so. And those that do will be. I almost feel like, I hate saying this, but I almost feel like the first attempt at this was like PCI, where they said, okay, if you want to, you know, process cards, you have to clear this bar, right?
Yeah.
And if you want insurance to help you for that day that will come, that will be potentially disastrous and financially hurtful, we will insure you, but you have to have A, B, and C. And yeah. My hope is that we get away from buy this, this, and this thing, and it's have X, Y, and Z processes. Yeah. So more SOC 2 and less, some of these NIST audit type things.
It'll be whatever the carriers say, because they're just interested in not having claims. They don't care if it's a process or a product. Why should they care? Whatever works, as far as they're concerned.
I guess they'll figure that out.
But cyber insurance as a as a concept is very nearly compulsory, just like other forms of business insurance. I'm not going to do business with you unless you have this level of E&O insurance or product liability insurance.
Right.
Cyber insurance is it will get to that exact same place where you won't be able to do a deal, you know, until you have it. So the question becomes, what's in the policy? What are the levels? What are the tolerances? What are they going to tell you to do? That's going to change everything, because think about like how customers model their programs now. Like if you want to do AV or SIEM or anything like that, where do you get your shortlist from? Probably like Gartner or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're not. You're going to get it from your carrier.
Well, I already saw this. One of my good friends and somebody I've had on the show a couple of times that actually has expertise in this, Sean Tuma, talks about, you know, the litigation side. And he's like, listen, customers think that they can just go pick whoever their DFIR company they want and whoever litigation company they want. He's like, nope, that's going to be dictated by whoever you buy your policy from.
Yep.
They're going to say, hey, here's four companies we trust, we believe in, and we choose. Pick one.
So now back to the security industry and why I like security liability is because you would much prefer putting a claim towards your security company than your carrier. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
If I get into a car wreck, I really don't want to put a claim in. Like I really.
I'm the insurance company, right? Yes. You have Costco up.
Yeah. So you're thinking about this. So the security industry is still has a unique opportunity to put their interest in alignment with their customers and take advantage of this market gap. I mean, it's there.
Oh man, there is that makes me hopeful, but I've been down this road before, Jer. I have been down this road and it is disappointing me every time.
You know, things are always hard. You know, this is a cultural sea change. It's hard. It takes time. You know, it's actually easy for the security vendors and the wholesale software vendors. That it's much, much harder for them because their products are much more complex.
That's fair.
And, you know, they have a lot more customers. They're dealing with a lot more dollars. It's different than, say, me doing it with one of my companies or a Microsoft doing it. That's night and day difference.
Yeah.
We have to start somewhere because we just had this major exchange issue, right? Can Microsoft can Microsoft really do much more than they've already been doing?
Yeah.
Like it's not, there's not much more like Microsoft can do. Everybody below them can do a lot more, but yeah, at some point,
that's fair.
You know, the software vendors are going to need to be in lockstep. I mean, otherwise it's still just a garage sale industry. All sales are final. You buy this stuff, you click the exclusive click-through agreement. It's a freaking garage sale.
I hate that explanation, but it's so true. It's crazy that software is one of those things that you buy and they're like, all right, you've clicked the agreement, you're on your own.
I mean,
it's like, wait a second.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. And you know, of course, the objections will be that software can never be perfect, and then just right back to everything in life, you know, has some kind of failure rate. Let's understand what the software one is. Just the one thing that I have to, you know, we have to noodle through is most things don't have to deal with a sentient adversary.
Yeah.
And that's our one difference. But there's something in this world called KNR insurance, kidnapping and ransom. They've worked through these models too. It's hard. The first time it's always hard. It doesn't take away the need by saying it's hard.
If it was easy, then what's the point, right? How long do you think before this becomes visible and then largely visible and then common? Are we talking 10 years, 15 years, 5 years?
It's funny. I'm usually pretty good about protecting what happens, but I suck at when. I'll see things coming. I know how the world should be structured. At least I think I do. I think we'll see the security industry get some kind of traction in doing... Well, let's take it back. Cyber insurance is going to be ubiquitous inside of 2 or 3 years. It's going to change everything. It'll be ubiquitous. How far will the security industry get? Well, it's either we're going to lead the charge, because it's a choice, and offer our own warranties, or we're going to be the home inspectors of the cyber insurance industry. We get to pick.
Well,
and then what the carriers will do, you know, with things like if you're running Microsoft, if you're running Oracle, if you're running this or that, they're going to set standards for what you can buy, what you can use, and what you can configure. They're going to set those.
I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, man, the insurance carriers are going to wield a tremendous amount of power. Does that then, I guess the next question is, with them driving the what you need to be doing to what bar you have to clear, does that weed out certain types of vendors or certain vendors that can they go as far as recommending vendors, or do you think that's a line too far?
Well, the insurance industry is not exactly innovative, right? They're going to go with what they know. And what they know is if you buy fire protection and fire insurance, they're going to say you need fire protection that looks and behaves like this. And if the customer ever goes, well, do you have a list that I can pull from? They'll go, yeah, here's 20. That's what the carriers will do.
Okay.
So if you'll go, we need a scanner. Well, any scanner? Well, no, one of these that do these things.
Yeah, one of these that actually does what they say as opposed to lies to you.
Or yeah, because it's in their best interest, because what'll happen is in the insurance industry, they call those panels. So if you want to get on the panel, you have to talk to the right person to get on the list, demonstrate your product. And, you know, maybe you get on the panels open up for additions once every year or two. And then if they see claims based in just like any other space that where your product doesn't work, you're off the list and you're never getting there again.
Well, I think that leads us into a space where I was kind of driving this to is, does that just start to weed out bad, like useless security companies that sell snake oil? I hope the answer is yes.
Yeah, I think it'll do two, when we get to that point, because the insurance industry moves very slow. So that part with cyber insurance panels, 3 to 5 years, cyber insurance, people buying it, 2 to 3, it'll be ubiquitous. Another 2 years after that, we'll probably get panels. Now two things happen. Things that suck will be ejected, but what's the really interesting one is actually makes it extremely hard on the startup. Something that's new, innovative, good, and works. How do you get onto the panel as a startup nobody? Before, you could go pay a lot of money to Gartner or do demos and things, but now all of a sudden you have the best new product. If you're not on the panel, the CISO can't buy you. So we have some give and take there that we have to see coming.
That is going to be interesting, right? Because even if, that certain companies have that problem already in certain areas.
Yeah.
Regulated space particularly, right? That problem already exists.
I have the best new firewall, the best new EDR, the best new vulnerability scanner. I really, really do. The customer goes, yes, I believe you, but I have to buy one of these over here.
Yeah. Yeah, that I guess that's one of those adverse reactions that we have to correct for before we get into that curve, or we'll slide right through that and end up with a world that's run by the equivalent of a Gartner.
well, it's going to be a little bit better, I think, than Gartner, because the carriers are going to run some financial models like these ones work because we don't get claims.
Yeah, well, that's true.
But they're going to miss the new opportunities. They're going to be stifle innovation. That they would get less claims or better performance by adding these startups. But I mean, it's an insurance company. The security industry can't tell between products either. Like which ones, we can't tell.
Well, remember, were you part of that group that, it's gotta be like 4 or 5 years ago now, when EDR was such a big thing, endpoint defense was such a, endpoint protection was such a big thing. We went around to all the endpoint vendors. A couple of us went around, I think Trey might have been involved. I could have sworn you got involved in that at some point. We went all the endpoint vendors. We took their literature, and then we basically typed it up, took out all the colors and the specific labeling, and nobody could tell their product apart.
Nobody can. Reviews and performance and side bake-offs is like the hardest thing in their entire industry. We don't know what works either. I mean, how do I or any other CISO, you know, aside from Gartner, get our short list of products to try? We call the next CISO over and goes, What did you try? What seems to be working? And
what works,
and that's really it. And then we'll put two products together or three or whatever, and we'll try it out, and okay, it didn't break anything.
Well, so the other interesting thing is, I think that the thing that's going to drive all this is we have to get better at identifying when something works. What I mean by that is just because you haven't noticed you've been breached doesn't mean the security products you have are working, right? So how do we get to a point where we can say, yes, these things work, as opposed to this is a really, really lucky product that simply hasn't been exploited yet?
It's a good question. It's the one we just don't have the data for. I mean, all our security data is backwards looking, meaning here's all the breaches that we've happened. This is how they happened. So let's do better. But we have no idea with a sentient adversary what they'll move to and try next. Like that's really, really hard, if not if possible. So, you know, back to something I said earlier, I think as an industry, we've largely hit peak prevention. We might be able to get a little bit more efficient with our spend on what products and services we buy and what percentages. But I think now we've moved to a world where we're gonna have to rely on fast detection and response. We're going to get hacked. Can we spot it in a day, in a week, in a month, and kick them off the system? I think the innovation and how we move the needle substantially is in that area. I think our innovation is right of boom, not left.
Yeah, when the last time we all sent you and Arsenake and a couple others that we all, and Gunther was there, we all sat around, was at, all together, was in a Gartner conference in National Harbor, wherever that was. And that was the one where I poked fun at Palo for a bit because they had the only dinosaurs detect, real security professionals prevent or something. And I'm going, but we've had 10, 15, 20 years of trying to prevent. We haven't gotten to a point where we're more than just, you know, some small increment better. You're right. It's the technology improvements got to come right of boom because we can't keep pushing the left any further.
Well, here's the thing. The person on stage, they didn't believe it either. They're just selling the party line. If you tell them, like, is that what you believe? Well, buy your products, sign up for the losses when it doesn't work. Sign here. They'll never do it. They don't believe it either.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting look. Security is such an interesting place, and in the 20 whatever some odd years I've been, I feel like the maturity has been so slow and oftentimes non-existent that this conversation genuinely gives me hope because if it's driven by financials and economics, a la insurance. It's going to have to happen. We're not going to make breaches go away. We've definitely seen no amount of magical AI, magic math bullshit's going to make us prevent everything. Okay, so that said, we're going to have to get better at detection and response, and ultimately the products are going to have to suck less on the defensive side, which means we have to get better at detection and response. And then the companies that are putting out crap, right, are going, or software or whatever, are going to have to get to a point where they are held liable for doing, at first, blatantly, obviously bad things, neglect. And then, start ratcheting that back. Maybe it's via class action lawsuits. I don't know. Maybe it's insurance. Because I guess they have to buy insurance too, don't they? I mean,
everybody does, yeah.
So maybe we go back that way too. And ultimately, wouldn't it be some crazy irony when, you know, 5-6 years ago, we were all saying, you can't just buy insurance, doesn't make things go away. And now we're like, you know, maybe insurance is the magic solution here.
Well, the thing is, it's, you watch the breaches just like I do, like all the things that happen, and we try to figure out what happened. What breach impressed you, meaning like we didn't know what to do, you know, in advance to stop it? Like, what breach caught us? Like, we were like, holy crap, those guys are really good. We couldn't have stopped that one. Like, what breach was that?
I think the one that came closest was SolarWinds, the SolarWinds thing, because we weren't really prepared to handle as an industry somebody going deep into our software supply chain.
Oh, no, but how did SolarWinds get hacked?
Identity.
Yeah, that is. Did we know how to prevent it? Sure, we did.
Yeah. Yeah, 10 years ago.
Yeah, like we did. So this is not like a technological problem anymore. It's cultural. It's incentives. Like, how do we get the right people to do the right things at the right time? The only lever I know of right now is financial, or if you want to get to regulation, jail time. I don't like those answers at all. But I think it's financial. We know the answers.
Yeah, I think jail time and all that, that just, it just gets into this realm of punishment and big scary things. And we've seen companies, I mean, outside of security companies, go under for horrible things. And their executives find a way to get before Congress to go, I'm so sorry, I didn't see this coming. And Congress goes, all right, fine. You know, you've paid us enough on the back end to make sure we don't punish you too hard. Like, we'll yell at you and then go, nah, sorry, don't worry about it. And like, and everything goes back to normal. Every breach that's had a CEO testify before Congress ends the exact same way. Public display of, you know, flogging. They take their lumps, they walk back into their, you know, get back in their corporate jet, go home, and like nothing ever happened. It's like, wait a minute. Yeah. So it's all performative theater.
So, but, you know, the business world moves by money, by incentives. And I think we can, you know, people can adjust a little bit, you know, just a little bit of liability goes a long way.
Yeah. Amen to that.
It's just, you know, software will get there. I mean, software liability isn't a unique concept. It's happened before. I mean, there's little pockets of examples. I just think it needs to be more broad, and I think customers have to understand that they deserve it.
Yeah, that's you deserve better software.
You do. I'm a security expert. You are too. I'm patch exhaustion, man. Like there's everything in my life is constantly patching. Is there ever a day where I don't have to patch something?
I tell you, I have gotten to the point, and I'm embarrassed to say this, where I see my Brave browser with the little update going from green to orange. I'm like, I don't want to close this tab. I'm still working. Yeah. I'll do it tomorrow. And you're like, wait a minute.
It's my phone. It's my browser. It's my operating system. It's my car. It's
seriously everything.
It's freaking everything. Like, it's the little apps on all these devices. Like, and let's not even talk about like my router firmware.
Well, your light bulbs, you know, your smart meters, like everything needs patches and updates. And it's gotten, you're right, it's gotten overwhelming and absurd. And something, I think the right something is probably so that liability and going down the insurance route. So, all right, man. Well, before you go too long, thank you for joining me on this and experimenting in the live format with me. It's kind of fun.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Brian. I appreciate it.
All right, folks, thanks for listening. Jeremiah Grossman, we were talking software liability and insurance and all that. And hopefully this changes the world for the better. And if not, then guess what? More hamster wheel of pain. But something's got to give, right? Jared, something's got to give. We're at that point?
Yep, we're there. I think we're ready.
All right. Well, folks, thanks for listening. This has been another edition of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. Check out the YouTube channel where this will be posted. If you didn't catch it live, look at the show notes. And I might include in the ID3 tag of the MP3 as well. But we'll catch you another time, another place, on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Thanks for listening. Ciao, y'all.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. Our website is whiterabbit.net, whiterabbit.net. So on behalf of Rafal, James, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.